Hello, Diane Kamikaze here. My guest today is Mr. Steve Diggle of Buzzcocks. Spoke to him on April 9th, 2015, about a week before they flew to New York to play. Let's hear what Mr. Diggle has to say. Thank you so much for being on the show. My special guest today is Steve Diggle of the Buzzcocks. I'm just going to sit here and like wiggle in my seat for a minute because this is really, really wonderful. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Yes, we've been touring in. We did Germany and Holland, and about a week ago we got back from Spain. We did 5 shows on there, which was good. And of course, the next 4 shows are heading towards the States. Yeah.
Yes, you are. You're going to be at Irving Plaza April 16th, the Stone Pony on the 17th, in Baltimore on the 18th, and then you're going to be doing the late night at with Seth Meyers show on the 20th.
Oh, good. Well, you know, we'll be promoting our new album. We'll be playing songs off that, the new album, The Way, you know.
That album, was that a Pledge Music record?
It was, yes.
How was that? How did that go for you?
Well, we just figured it was a new format to try. And it's almost like back in the early 70s, people used to, you know, order a record and it'd take a few weeks to come in, you know.
Right.
Back in the dark ages.
That's true.
So it is kind of like pre-sales, really. And it means your actual fans are voting with their feet for the record. So, you know, it's the fans' record as well, because they kind of made it. Not really a record company, you know. So we figured out, you know, it's a new way to try things.
Was it a way to connect with the fans more also? Were you on the site a lot looking at the comments?
Well, you know, we had different ranges of different vinyl and different things going on, a lot more than we can do with record companies these days sometimes, you know.
Yes.
So there was a lot more choice of the novelty things. It's even coming out on cassette, which I'm excited about.
Oh, nice.
In the States, yeah. Mm-hmm. 1, 2, 3, 4 gold records. I'm hoping when I come to come over, I'll be getting my copy of, you know, on a cassette.
Nice. Are you a record collector, Steve?
Well, I have a lot of records. I must have been over the years, you know, over 50 years, I think I've collected a lot of records, you know.
And you still have them? You still have your vinyl?
I still have them all, yeah. It's one of those things where they kind of said, you should throw them away, and there's new things called CDs, and then they're telling you to throw those away, you know. But there's something kind of personal about when you're a teenager and you're buying your first albums, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and
And if you've still got them with you all that time, then, you know, they've been through a few houses and a few things, but you kind of look at them and you know every mark on the record sleeve, you know, with some of them. So, yeah, you know, I've still got them all, so I could never throw them away. I mean, they kind of mean, well, they're like life itself, you know.
Oh, they are. And, well, especially for you, there's, you know, being a musician and having it be almost like a scrapbook for you. Do you know what the first record you ever bought was?
The first album was the Beatles' Help. I was about 12 years old then, but it was a big deal going to the shop because they were expensive in those days, you know. And that was back in about 64 or 65. So, I had a whole bunch of records that I think somebody gave me. I made a swap and. One of them was the Beatles' Twist and Shout, and I think there was a Rolling Stones record there. And there's also Elvis's Wooden Heart. which back in about 1963, that made me laugh or whenever it came out. I used to wonder what the German bit was in the middle. Stage Lady Mouse, you know. So I'd got a bunch of records there I had to root through. I think I'd swapped them for something else. Singles, anyway.
Well, I mean, you know.
So, but then you go on the whole journey of discovering, you know, everything, isn't it? From John Lee Hooker to Chuck Berry and Little Richard and stuff like that. Because Little Richard was on the TV over in our local station in Manchester very early on, you know, some great black and white footage. It's probably on the YouTube now, but it's still as exciting as ever, that stuff, you know.
So was there a lot of like, music on TV when you were growing up?
Well, like I say, these kind of programs, these were like made by a local TV station. So they'd have like Thelonious Monk on doing some jazz and weird stuff like that, and Little Richard and stuff.
Wow.
And of course, a bit later on in the 60s, then there was a program called Ready, Steady, Go and Top of the Pops over here. So it started to get like popular kind of chart shows, but you know. They started to crystallize and formulate into some kind of charts or some kind of 60s, swinging 60s kind of TV event, you know. But those other things were, you know, when Little Richard was on and stuff, that was before they knew how to handle pop music, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well,
but yeah, so you'd watch all that, you know.
And what would you say for yourself was really an early influence? And did you start off by playing guitar? I know in the Buzzcocks you started off playing bass on the Spiral.
Yeah, I only played the bass for 6 shows. Then Howard left and I moved over to guitar. Yeah.
Okay.
Because I wasn't really a bass player as such. It's just that I kind of run into those little guys and I had a bass, you know. But really, I was going to meet another guy and form my own group and play the guitar, you know.
That's a good thing that
didn't happen.
Which
it works out in a weird way in this.
Yes.
In the Buzzcocks. Actually, I think we did about 6 shows with Howard, and then he left, and I moved. It was a good opportunity for me to move over to guitar, you know. I'd written a song at home called Fast Cars, which is a lot slower than Buzzcocks do it, but I had that, and I was going to form my band with this other guy, you see.
Oh.
And I arranged to meet him, and I met Pete Howard instead by accident.
Really?
Yeah, introduced by Malcolm McLaren.
Oh, my goodness, how funny.
Who actually thought I was somebody, they was expecting somebody else, not me, and I was expecting to meet somebody else.
Wow.
So the two different people we were supposed to meet, we never actually met them. We met each other instead, if you see them.
That's great.
So that's a weird twist of fate, you know?
It certainly is. And it's a nice... we have all benefited from that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I did, you know, the bass for... Well, on Spiral Scratch, I played bass, and then... I think we did about 6 or 8 shows, and then Howard said he was leaving. So at that moment, I said, well, look, when he left, it's like, look, I'll move over to guitar, and let's get another bass player, and then I'll feel a lot better, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Jimmy Page did in the Yardbirds, too. Yeah.
Right. And then...
Jimmy Page was playing bass in the Yardbirds
mm-hmm.
when he kind of started out with him.
There you go.
And then moved over to guitar, and he was forming a band called the New Yardbirds, which became Led Zeppelin.
Yes, yes. What else?
But he started out on bass as well, so it's a weird route, really, you know.
Mm-hmm. What else do you have in common with Jimmy Page?
Oh, a lot of things. Girls, drugs, you name it. Bull whips. Somebody gave my name in the Atlanta, Georgia. They said you can have anything you like in the shop. So I'm like, you know, I've got all the T-shirts, excuse me, and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the bullwhip.
Funny.
That was a long time ago.
So,
I mean, you know, kind of grew up with Led Zeppelin before punk and stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Beatles had split up and Led Zeppelin sort of, it was like the new wave thing, you know.
Mm-hmm. So, and going back to when you switched from bass to guitar, that was also when Howard left the band. What was it really terrible? Was it like, all right, he's leaving and you didn't care? Was it so early in the band's formation that it didn't really upset things? Or what was actually going on at the time when Howard left?
Me and Pete were sat in his house and he just came in and all of a sudden said, I've achieved what I wanted to do, make a record, I'm leaving, you know.
Oh.
So we kind of looked at each other and I was shocked for about a minute and then said, well, we're going to carry on, you know, because we'd just started, you know. So it was the best thing you did, really, because mm-hmm. you went off on magazine and then the Buzzcocks really became the Buzzcocks. I don't think it would have been able to carry on much longer, you know, with Howard in there, really.
Mm-hmm. Do you,
the Buzzcocks, as we know them, love them now, you know, with the two guitars and all that. You know, that was all meant to be. So it was kind of good in a way, you know.
Mm-hmm. So
and in another way, I was a bit separate from the rest of us, in a sense, you know. Whereas me and Pete gelled a bit more. So on a practical working level, it made more sense that way, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, like I say, it was a little surprise because we thought, well, that's the lineup. And then, you know, we soon turned it round and developed a unique style from there, really.
So are you a fan of Magazine?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I was a fan of Magazine, yeah. So I thought that suited Howard better, really, you know.
Well,
and also, you got two bands for the price of one with him leaving, you know.
Right, right, exactly.
You know, kind of got a supermarket deal out of it. I was a fan of Magazine, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't, you know, the Buzzcocks, couldn't have dragged the Buzzcocks through all that. What Magazine were doing, really, you know.
Well, I think I think his leaving freed the Buzzcocks up to
oh,
really.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. To, well,
it became a different band, you know. There was a different sense about it. So I think he did about 6 or 8 shows or something and then he left. So it was all pretty quick when he was with us. But when he did leave, like I say, it did free us up a lot more, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, then we had about 7 or 8 hits in the charts here and all that kind of stuff, you know. It became more of a band, more of a four-way pull, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot sexier, you know. You look at those other guys in the early pictures and albums, you know.
Mm-hmm. That must have been an amazing time, just in terms of the music explosion and the club scene. And how old were you at that time?
20, going on 21.
Okay.
When we started then.
So you were more or less an adult.
Seems very young now, but at the time we felt really old.
Mm-hmm.
It was a magical time, particularly right in the beginning, you know. Everything was happening, you know. The music was happening. The excitement in the streets and the clubs, you know. Each town, they started putting, you know, there was different clubs in each town, like a scene developed in each place. And, you know, the art, the clothes, everything was good, you know. Suddenly people came alive, like the whole the country came alive. And, of course, it was happening in the States in a different way. You know, suddenly it became global. You've got to remember that time. There was there was no mobile phones or computers, and word of mouth is faster than an email.
And it was all you—it was all you had, really. You had to really dig for it and go out and bring it to yourself.
Yeah, but it's amazing how much people knew, you know. It's amazing how many people have heard of all the different bands going around, different songs. You know, that went on the just on the word of mouth network and a few other things. You know, I mean, like I say, like now we can just put it on the internet. But everybody, you know, this kind of punk rock thing connected with the world, you know, by that moment. So it was a very exciting time.
Yeah, absolutely. And at the time, I certainly don't know if you can remember, but did you know that that period of time was going to be remembered forever as really like the fuel and the foundation of a whole generation of music that really made a difference for people?
No, you knew there was something kind of special about it, but I remember doing a double take sometimes and thinking, it's just going to be, you know, is this for a few weeks just like, you know, to create this excitement and stuff, or is it... it's just going to be history, like legendary history in a few years, isn't it?
Mm.
I do remember thinking that a couple of times at the time, but not really saying, you know, it wasn't like, I wasn't overly worried about it, but I thought, wow, this is so incredible, it might be remembered in years to come, yeah. Because people did become alive, and it affected people in many ways. It was a very powerful force. It was, you know, it was beyond just making songs and music. It was like an attitude, whole way of thinking. When you listen to those punk records at that time, you had to rethink your whole consciousness about how you listen to music and what it's doing to you, you know. It wasn't just simply entertainment. And so I think that was very powerful, like you say, for a whole generation, you know.
Oh, and for generations to come, for sure.
And generations to come, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
There are a lot of those records. I mean, a lot of our Buzzcocks records still sound like they made last week. You know,
they do.
Which amazes me, because at the time we'd go in and make these records.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't think how, you know, you weren't worried how long they're going to last. But they still sound as fresh. That's something, you know, we didn't predict or really thought about when we was making them, but when you hear them, like I say, they still sound as relevant now as ever, you know.
Well, and I think there's something about the Buzzcocks music inherently that just does sound fresh by virtue of your style. I don't even know quite how to say that in any other way. But
yes, I mean, we did have a very distinctive style, that's true, you know. There's only one Buzzcocks, you know.
Yes.
Really, but you could hear echoes of Buzzcocks in other people's records.
Oh, and many, many.
We got going, because
yeah. We
were kind of like early on the block with the Clash and the Pistols and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We were like the first people on the block over here back in 76. But we definitely did have a definitive, unique sound, you know. I think that's what sets us apart from a lot of people, you know. I mean, the songs were always important. We always had a sense of the songwriting and the riffs and all the things. You always got a good guitar riff with a Buzzcocks song, you know, which was like a little tune in itself, you know.
Yes.
A little piece in itself.
Yes, yes.
And, of course, the backing vocals. And the rocking guitars, you know. But there's a certain way of playing and a certain way of doing it. That's the chemistry, particularly between me and Pete, you know.
Right, yes.
And it's something we've never actually practiced or sat down and concentrated on.
Well,
it's something that's just come really natural, you know.
Yeah, something that can't be reproduced. You hear influence everywhere. Back in the, you know, when the whole sort of punk scene was starting, I know that you were in the scene. Was there any distinction made between, like, distinguishing punk and pop? Like, if I were to describe the Buzzcocks' music, I would always say hard pop or punky, because I never felt that there was hardly ever arrogance. It was always, your lyrics were always just very wry and fun, or, you know, about love, like not so much about society and, you know, or like clash type subjects. Did you ever distinguish between like pop versus punk in that time?
Yeah, I mean, with Spiral, Scratch and Boredom, I think we were very punky, you know, and then we had that song Orgasmatic, which was really quite punky.
Mm-hmm.
And a song called Oh Shit and stuff. Mm-hmm. But he was like, okay, we've kind of done that now. And we made more, like, Amps a big tune for a record. We had to move on and look for other things. And plus the fact there was we started with the Nucleus of the Damned and the Pistols and the Clash and that. And they all seemed to have a separate sort of sensibility about things. But it seemed like our Clash of 76. When other punks came along, it seemed a lot different from what we were doing, you know. You know, people kind of finger-pointing and simply blaming the government. We knew the world was a lot more complex than that, you know. So our lyrics were a little bit more existentialist, or, you know, looking at the world in a more complex way than simply screaming and shouting about, you know, mm-hmm. the government's wrong or something. Because there seems to be a lot of that kind of thing. It's, they're all welcome for the party, you know. But I don't think they made the greatest records, you know, some of those kind of bands. But they're there for all part of the scene, you know.
Well, and especially, you know, from my view from the States, it's like you guys and really like the Damned had love songs that had more relatable music. You know, relatable lyrics to kids.
Yeah, I mean, we sang about a human condition.
Yeah.
Kind of like Shakespeare in a way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and people can relate to that on many levels, you know. And also, it's like we are being human on the records. It doesn't sound like we're trying to bull people with something, you know. It doesn't sound like we're trying to make a hit to, you know, win them over and twist their minds into thinking they've got some catchy song, you know.
Right.
There's kind of realism on there as well as a romantic thing. But like I said, we had them early kind of punk ones, and then, you know, we had other ones. We had experimental ones like Autonomy and Why Can't Touch It, you know, it's group.
Mm-hmm.
And songs like Harmony in My Head, which is, that's definitely not a love song, you know. So we covered a lot of ground, really.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we're kind of known for a few, like, kind of love-type songs, but we've got about 100 songs out there.
Right.
About all kinds of things, isn't it?
Right, right. Yeah, no,
I'll say the human condition, the whole spectrum.
Yeah, exactly.
This bag of flesh and blood we don't walk about.
And we all can relate to that, yeah.
Well, yeah. That's the kind of sensitive side we've got, and perhaps the deep sea diver and has asked to submerge into our souls to find out who we are and what's going on at that moment.
Mm. And so
and
who,
if we can find any treasures hidden deep within us, then we'll try and polish them up and put them in the sun, you know.
And so then who would you say that Steve Diggle is today?
Sorry?
Who would you say that Steve Diggle is today?
The same as he was then, but with experience now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just a broader Proustian picture, you know. I can see the world in there. Massive panoramic vision now, you know.
Awesome.
Whereas years ago, there's a lot of things you thought you could see that weren't there. So, but I still feel angry and I still feel political and all the rest of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We had songs like Sound of a Gun as well and stuff like that, you know. why she's a girl from a chainsaw, that's asking a sociological question. So mm-hmm. those are my favourite departments, really. Still questioning society in their way. And that's why I'm here to do, really. It's a little bit of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, rock out with the guitar, you know.
Of course. But,
you know, we're all looking for who we are, but after looking all this time, is it really that important to know every detail about yourself, you know?
Just concentrate on having a good time.
I don't think anybody really knows themselves that well, you know.
Who would want to?
Huh?
Who would want to?
Well, exactly, you know. Yeah. If you knew yourself, everything about yourself, there's nothing to discover, you know.
Right, exactly. Have fun and get to
You'd
know
be
others.
You'd be a perfect human being. In fact, you'd be an android. You'd be a creation made by society. You know?
I have a question here from a listener. We have a live comments board, and a listener asked how much was the band involved in the record designs about concerning the 7-inch covers that Malcolm Garrett designed way back, the singles?
Quite a bit. I mean, particularly on the first one, because I spent up, I remember staying up till 6 o'clock one night with him in the morning when we just finished in the studio, and he brought the album. And it was like a collage of all teeth and eyes and stuff. And it took me a few hours to convince him we need a photograph on there to introduce the band, really.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of it, and that's on another Music in a Different Kitchen, which is a kind of silver sleeve with orange lines in there.
Mm-hmm.
But he'd done all that, and I simply asked for the pictures to be put on rather than his collage. So there's a bit of interaction like that, really. He's just the general outline of most of the stuff, all the colour schemes and things.
Mm-hmm.
But we might put a bit of input in here and there on once he comes up with something, you know. But essentially, he had a kind of unique style quite early on, which gave us a kind of identity in a way. You know?
Yeah, that sort of minimal graphic style was just...
Quite a lot of the singles are like two colours. If you notice, it's like two shades of green, or like a brown and a cream was one single.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of weird now, he just put two colours together on something, quite a lot of the singles. So, particularly at that time, it was very unique, you know, very... he had a very distinctive style that went hand in hand with the records, didn't it?
Yes, yes.
I just wanted to watch that. It wasn't a platform for him to do his artwork and forget that, you know, this is a record sleeve for a band, you know.
Mm.
Because if you look at all them lovely Who sleeves and Kink sleeves, and there's some fantastic rock and roll design from there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Record sleeve art, neat thing in itself, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
And some of the basic standard ones, and some of them ones in the 60s, were fantastic designs. But it wasn't that arty, it was more to do with, like, you know, looking like a record and using the simple record logos and the logo of the record company and all that stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But all that was beautiful, you know, in its own right. You know? So I used to try and maintain that it still had a bit of old school record look about it, as well as a futuristic look. You know?
Oh, yeah.
That was my beef with him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else didn't bother, but he was like, you know, like I say, it wasn't just a canvas for him to do his artwork on. It was our records or albums, you know. So, but I think we got kind of a balance out of it, you know.
Oh, definitely.
So yeah. That kind of works, you know.
Yep. Yeah.
If there's a yin and yang with it all and it's all nice, then it, you know what I mean? Art doesn't kind of work like that. You've got to have that dynamics and a bit of frustration. So, but yeah, you know, the sleeves do work. So we had input on quite a lot of them, but he'd have most of the work to answer the question. He'd turn up with most of the colour schemes and most of the design, and we'd ask him to just move a few things or maybe put a picture here and there or something.
Neat.
So, you know, that's kind of worked. Mm-hmm. But that was our input, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well,
although, having said that, on the new one, the way Malcolm doesn't do it on that one, so we had a lot of input on that one to make it like a Banksy and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If you've seen the album, the way it looks like
it looks like an artist
over here, Banksy, has sprayed us all on the wall.
On the wall, yeah. Yeah, the brick
wall. Which I thought was a little different from the Malcolm style, and it was time for a change, you know.
Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, your style was completely established. Once you establish a style, you can do anything with it.
Yeah.
You know, or leave it completely, because that'll never go away. It was
just that, you know,
the series of the first singles and some of the first albums just had such a look, and it was really, you know, delightful as a consumer, as a music person and buying records. It was like a new comic book coming out, kind of like, oh, wow, the new Buzzcocks record. Oh, look at this one. You know, and you started to really get the idea that there was a series and there was some connection, something that pulled it together. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really, really.
I mean, there was a little bit of playfulness on about consumerism. You know, the first album that was released over here, I know it wasn't released in the States right away.
Mm-hmm.
I think Singles Going Steady was the first release in the States.
Right, yes, on IRS.
Over here we had an album called Numb Music in a Different Kit.
Right.
And the plastic bag that came in, Buzzcocks bag, it had in huge letters products written on it, which was the beginning of that, like I say, a little bit of playfulness about the consumerism sort of side of things. It just had product written on the plastic bag. When you come out of the shop, they had that, you know. And I think there's a few other moments like that on the sleeves as well. Dealing with the consumer world, or, you know, what I say.
Nice.
Being flirtatious or playful with it.
Mm-hmm.
Which was, I guess, kind of different at the time, you know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well,
it's almost like you bought a punk record, but we are making you wear your bought products as well, you know.
Right, yeah.
You had a bit of a weird...
And you guys put out...
A weird mindset about it, you know. But also, it did make you think and make you smile as well, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you guys put out one of the first sort of independent, like, band-produced records, right? Spiral Scratches on your own New Hormones label?
The reason we put that, we thought we're making the most uncommercial music possible at the time. And if we went to a record company, they wouldn't understand it. So it's seen as a stroke of genius. But it was also a stroke of necessity that I think it was £500 to make 1,000 singles.
Oh, wow.
And that's what we did, you know. We made our own singles just to sell to a few local people when we do the show in Manchester. And what happened was... Rough Trade Records in London had just said that, you know, they'll press up some more for us. So suddenly it turned into this sort of big underground record in a way.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Inspired a lot of people to go out and make their own record, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I know they were doing that in the 50s in the States anyway, you know, like little independent labels and stuff, but at that moment in time, people had kind of forgotten about it, particularly in Britain. So it was like, well, you don't have to go to a record company on your hands and knees begging, you know. you can actually make one yourself, you know. But it's a weird concept, really. At the time, it was like, wow, why didn't we think of that before, you know? You know, everybody's kind of looking around, hoping to get a record deal, you know?
Right.
So I think that opened a lot of doors for other people as well, you know. It gave a platform for other bands to make records and get through. But I think we was one of the first on the block over here, if not the first.
Yeah, I think so. I know that, you know, in the U.S. it was different, and I, you know, was a huge record buyer at the time in the, you know, the 70s and,
yeah,
and 80s. And but most of the 45s,
yeah,
that were coming out, most of the records that were coming out were on major labels. Like, punk was definitely, you know, in popular there. And a lot of the a lot of some of the earlier bands in the States did have to put out their own records.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of bands, we took quite a while to sign up to a major label. It was, I say, we'd put that record out.
Mm.
So at that time, for a while, we almost did, you know, people were coming to the shows. Every time we almost didn't read the record company at that moment.
Right.
But eventually, it was kind of like, well, there's a demand for these records, so we couldn't be there. But, you know, we put a few of the records in the picture sleeves. You had to take them out of a thin white sleeve, or just, you know, standard sleeves, and then put it in the picture one, you know.
Yes.
Well, after we'd done that for about 10 minutes, I mean, it drove us mad. We're suffering from alienation. And had to go to the pub, you know. So it was like we couldn't carry on doing that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually we did sign. But, I mean, we had about six record companies coming to see us, but we took a long time to sign because we didn't want them telling us what we should be doing and controlling, you know, our destiny, really. Because the Clash had just signed to CBS and they were being told what to do and this and that. And, of course, they made records complaining about the record company trying to turn them over, you know.
Right.
you know.
That's
music. It's a weird inversion. But realize it was like, well, you know, if we do sign the record deal, the first record we want to find out is called Orgasmatic, you know.
Mm.
That caused a lot of uncomfort, you know, with a few record companies.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, when that record was being pressed, it was actually delayed because the pressing plant came out on strike saying, we're not going to print this filth.
Oh.
So it was delayed while the record label had to persuade the staff that it was art, you know. That old guy's money was art and not just pure, you know, gratuitous filth.
Everybody's always going to have
an
opinion.
The release date was brought back 3 weeks for that.
And so what do you do these days that has nothing to do with music? What do you enjoy that has nothing to do with music?
You know, I enjoy just walking down the streets, people watching, you know. I just keep walking like Forrest Gump, you know. I know he's running, but I just enjoy observing things, really. I say walking down the streets, looking like an artist or a poet, observing people's mannerisms, everything about them, you know. And all the high streets of London here or wherever I am. It's just amazing to look at all, you know. It's a big art piece, really.
Mm.
Apart from that, I need to, you know, I've made three solo albums now. I need to get around to make some more, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and
but generally, I just want around observing, really, observing the landscape.
Mm-hmm. So,
and I'm really happy with that, you know.
And The Way is the latest record from Buzzcocks, and that came out last year. And you guys are going to be here next week in New York at Irving Plaza, and then you'll be at the Stone Pony. That's the 16th and the 17th of April, and then in Baltimore, and then you'll be doing the late night with Seth Meyers' show. In closing, I just really want to thank you just for doing the interview, because this was very, very last minute. But just really to thank you for the music, because, you know, you mentioned before, yeah, it's like, oh, well, a couple of generations of people. But that's really a couple of generations of people. Like, you've really changed lives. Like, really, it's not, you know, it's not a written on a piece of paper fact. Like, real people with real hearts beating. Like,
it's amazing how many young people come to the shows now, you know.
Of course.
Two-thirds generally around the world are younger people that got to it in bar at the time.
Well, and you're...
That's pretty amazing. You know, it's a test of the body of work, really.
Mm-hmm.
And how we relate to people, you know. How we relate to people through those records. So it is amazing that, like you were just saying, the generation, you know, it's spanned a few generations now, isn't it?
Yeah. And you've affected millions of people, you know.
If anything about that, you know, I never thought about it at the time, but I think when I was starting out, I thought, if you can affect people in some ways, that would be a great thing, you know. More than just a tune or a bit of fame or success. You know, to be actually have some powerful input to inspire people, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I think at least Buzzcocks are inspiring one way, you know. Even for the underdogs or whoever, you know what I mean? There's still some inspiring about just simply being a human, you know. I think there's a lot of that in Buzzcocks' records, you know. It's like, look, we all have the problems, you know. We're all facing this and that, or we can all climb the mountains. There's a lot of things going on in those lyrics, you know, that people can relate to. And indeed, we're doing the Stone Pony. I've met the boss a couple of times on the... when he's played over here.
Uh-huh.
And there was Stephen.
Yes.
And he's got a Buzzcocks... Bruce has got a Buzzcocks record.
Awesome.
Yeah, when I met him, I said, you know, I'm Steve, I'm playing the Buzzcocks. He said, I know you are, Steve. He said, I've got all your records at home. So that was a great compliment.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So now the boss has got him, and then we're going to have a nice home turf there at the Stone Pony, aren't we?
It's like one big circle.
Yeah, that's a little story for the Stone Pony anyway.
Yeah, and so much love and respect for you guys, because you do really get to speak for us. We can relate to your music. You make our moments better, because, I mean, all your songs are really, you know, they sound fun and uplifting, even if the lyrics are, you know, wry or uncover something that maybe we don't want to talk about. But Buzzcocks' music is so relatable, and so many people just have gotten so much out of your music. So, yeah. Thank you.
Yes. Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure, you know.
And I just want to... do you remember coming to WFMU and playing in East Orange, New Jersey many, many years ago? You had the...
Crazy,
You had the Winnebago, and that was the day that I...
We get around to a lot of places, but it's slowly coming back to me.
Well, here's the thing that you might remember, because I was there. I was the engineer on the session, and it was terrible. You weren't terrible, but it was not the greatest setup. We didn't have a great professional setup. But that was the day that IRS Records went under, and they were going to take the Winnebago away.
Wow.
So thank you. And thank you for being a friend of WFMU, because you guys have been in our history also for decades. You know,
yes.
And what you bring.
Yes. Well, yes.
Yeah. And what you bring to the world, you just bring, you know, wonderment and cheerfulness and wonderful music. And Buzzcocks songs are masterpieces, you know, so.
Well, thank you so much for that. You know, it's, I suppose it's just about some reason why we do it, you know. That's the thing is, you know, it mean a lot to us as well, you know. We put a lot into it in our hearts and souls, you know.
You do. Very much.
Not very
so.
Passionate about it in a way, you know. So, I'm glad it's been received like that.
Absolutely. So I'm going to let you go, and I'll just say that the latest Buzzcocks record is called The Way, and Buzzcocks will be performing at Irving Plaza on April 16th in New York City, at the Stone Pony on April 17th in Asbury Park, New Jersey, and at the Soundstage in Baltimore the 18th, and then you'll be on Late Night with Seth Meyers on the 20th. Steve Diggle, thank you very, very much. And everybody loves you. I've got all the listeners. I have a comments board here, and people are just like, thank you, thank you, thank you. Fabulous. Major respect. And the band endures. And thank you so much for your time.
And pleasure. Thanks very much. I'm really looking forward to coming over and playing the shows, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
That's one of things the Buzzcocks do best, make exciting shows.
For sure. Absolutely. Yeah. So we're really looking forward to it. Enjoy the rest of your day, sir.
Okay, thank you very much. And I might go to the pub after this now and have a British pint of beer.
There you go. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
And we're looking forward to coming over and playing.
Excellent. Right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
And that wraps things up. Thank you to Steve Diggle for making the time. It was almost an impromptu phone call. If you knew what I went through to get that, you would be laughing. The podcasts are managed by Liz Berg, and for WFMU, I am Diane Kamikaze. See you next time. Thank you for tuning in.